You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bow. He shattered the mold and all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor for 538. With me in the studio, it's Neil Statman Payne. Hi, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Good to see you.
You too.
We are absent, our third member in the studio, but on the other line, from Los Angeles, is that right, Kate?
That is correct.
It's Kate Fagan, ESPN W columnist, and the designer of Hot Takedown's exclusive line of championship beer goggles that Kevin Durant was modeling last night.
Kate, what did you
think
of them?
Beautiful. They really
did?
Sleek. I liked, they almost looked aerodynamic, you know, so he could continue to run down the court with the beer coming out of his face if that was necessary.
Yeah.
The seal on the sides looked really good, you know, and I know that Durant, his contacts bother him when the beer gets in there, so I thought that was a really important innovation, that patented tri-rubber seal flex that
you
designed.
Yeah, it's obviously a seasonal product, but we're really excited about its potential.
Yeah, really, really proud of your efforts here at Hot Takedown. All right, guys, before we do the rundown, can I just say, last weekend I went to the Basketball Hall of Fame to get ready for our discussion of the NBA Finals. Have either of you been?
I have been, yes.
Did you find it as underwhelming as I did?
Yes.
Well, I was 12 years old, and so little is underwhelming when you're 12.
Yeah.
So I was overwhelmed by its greatness, but
it's
I need a return trip.
Its most interesting thing was that it organized its player groupings by the year that they were inducted in. But, you know, it's inducting people from the 30s pretty regularly, and where that is, or not 30s, but, you know, old school pre-league players during the barnstorming era. And where that was particularly evident was that the Hall of Fame went, I think it was 25 at least years of inducting no women. But at the same time, the first 25 years, but at the same time, it was trying to like really be egalitarian about showing how the evolution of the women's game and the men's game was pretty much concurrent. And so there was this like really remarkable disconnect where the modern Hall of Fame clearly wanted to embrace the women's game and women playing and girls playing basketball. But the ancestors or the sort of prior generation of Hall of Fame stewards had totally ignored the women's game clearly with who was inducted. And it was this very interesting tension. So Kate, when you go back, I'd be curious for your thoughts.
Yeah, 12-year-old me would not have picked up on that. I wasn't yet like wary of the ways of the world. So I'll go back with those goggles on.
Excellent. All right. Now, finally, what we are going to talk about on today's show, we're going to have a long conversation about the Warriors' accomplishment. They won the NBA championship yet again. Was this the best team of all time? And if so, what made them so good? Our colleague Kyle Wagner will be in the studio to help talk about that. And then we'll close out the show with a significant digit on Rafael Nadal's remarkable feat at the French Open. He won his 10th French Open of his career. But first, for a little headline segment, let's talk about the MLB draft. Probably the least heralded draft, would you say?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, definitely.
All of them. So many players. They're also green. They take so long
so
for them to ripen
them
before they get...
So few of them actually end up impacting our game.
Exactly.
We don't follow, you know, college and high school baseball religiously also, so you have no idea who they are.
Unlike the religious following of college hockey that I do.
Yes. Frozen Four.
So with the number one pick in the 2017 MLB draft, the Minnesota Twins passed over the guy who was sort of regarded as the top prospect, who was a pitcher named Hunter Green, and they went for this shortstop named Royce Lewis, who's a high school shortstop. And Neil, you've done some thinking about like the right way to draft, especially vis-a-vis Moneyball, which sort of came out in, 2004, and Billy Beane's ideas about how to draft and whether to draft old players or young players was really influential for a while. And so I'm wondering if that's still the case, that what Beane thought is still valid. And then how does that affect how we should think about the Twins' first draft pick?
Yeah, one of the big things in Moneyball in the book was don't draft high school pitchers. They turn into busts at like an incredible rate. And being even like at one point, his scouting director takes a high school pitcher in the first round. And in front of like all of the family members of the scouts and like this, you know, meeting, this room of people that have congregated for the draft, he throws a chair through a wall out of frustration with the pick. So, you know, obviously Michael Lewis sort of sets that scene also in the book, but there's a lot devoted to this idea that college players are more reliable, college pitchers, you know, have this great return on investment and things like that. And that was true, especially back in the period of time in which he would have sort of looked at, you know, the trends of the draft. Bill James was looking at this even in a previous generation, that high school players and high school pitchers in particular were these terrible risks, and that college pitchers outperformed expectations a lot. Over the past couple decades of drafts, though, those rules have kind of been flipped on their head, and college pitchers have become overvalued, probably because teams sort of did their own studies and they picked up on the same trends that Billy Beane did. And so you ended up seeing college pitchers get taken too high and produce too little to justify their picks. And high school pitchers have become relative steals and bargains, and high schoolers in general have sort of closed the gap where now, for the first time ever, at least looking back at the most sort of recent generation of draft picks that we can kind of judge their careers in full, it's pretty much a toss-up between whether you should draft a high schooler or a college player, and really only college hitters stand out in particular as still being sort of these great value picks.
Well, what has actually shifted, or is it just a different way to look at the numbers between high school pitchers and college pitchers, or do we think that there's been an effect from the overdrafting of college pitchers that is like trickled down?
I think it's probably more, yeah, just the fact that teams have sort of overinvested in some areas and underinvested and kind of like overcorrected themselves that caused these things to be, the values of different types of players to change. As far as whether or not, you know, the raw talent of certain positions has changed in sort of an absolute sense, I mean, you know, pitchers are throwing harder at younger ages than ever before. And we now know that pitchers sort of, you know, their velocity is almost this like continuously dwindling resource from the age that they get drafted or when they're even in high school downward. You sort of lose velocity almost consistently throughout your career. And so, you know, teams have really picked up on this fact that the way the structure of Major League Baseball salaries are, you get the most bang for your buck with, especially with pitchers, when you get them super young, you know, use their ability to throw hard while it still lasts, and you're paying them much less than market rate, and then you sort of, you know, burn them out. It's a little like running backs in football now. And so, you know, no doubt that that has also played into the way that teams approach who they're going to draft, because, you know, a high school pitcher now suddenly seems very, appetizing if you're a team and you know about the way that he's going to age and the way that you can kind of, you know, exploit the system of salaries.
Interesting. All right, let's leave it there in our new spirit of short top segments and get right to the meat of the show about the NBA. The Golden State Warriors went 16-1 in the NBA playoffs this year, polishing off the Cavaliers in Game 5 of the NBA Finals on Monday night. We're recording this on Tuesday, still basking in the glow of the Warriors' feat, 2 out of 3 championships, all 3 of those years against the Cleveland Cavaliers. Here to talk about it is Kyle Wagner. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Chad.
Kyle, of course, is our colleague at 538. So I want to spend the next bit going deep into the Warriors' greatness, you know, what makes them so good, what that means for the NBA going forward, what that tells us about LeBron's legacy, especially because he keeps coming up against the Warriors here. But I guess maybe let's start at the top, which is the big overarching question that many people are asking. Is this Warriors team the best of all time? Before we all jump into it, let's listen to Will Cain and Stephen A. Smith on First Take.
You love your analytics. You love to talk about things people don't understand, like ELO and quote 538. They're all against you on this. They all say this is the toughest competition any champion has faced. What the Warriors have done is tougher than what the Bulls did facing the teams you just named.
How many 60-win teams did they win in the playoffs? Zero.
Stephen A.
I feel like I'm listening to a damn episode of Star Trek. You know,
We boldly go where no man has gone before. Oh, stop it. Here's the reality. They're not the greatest team ever. They're an elite team. They're an elite offensive team. Competition matters. They really didn't face anybody until they went up against Cleveland. In the end, what are we talking about here? You talk about the best team ever. If Jordan, Pippen, and Rodman were guarding them, would they have looked this way in the series?
All right, Neil, there's a lot packed in there. Let's just start at the ELO case, since the ELO has been invoked in that take before Stephen A. Smith jumped on. Neil, what do the numbers say with our little power rankings that we like to use around 538?
Yeah, so we looked at ELO both in terms of like end of season, peak ELO, like the highest that a team achieves during a season. And then we did a little sort of blending of all of those things plus like your average ELO over the course of the season. And no matter how you cut those, the Warriors finished the 2017 season as the single greatest, you know, seasonal performance in NBA history. Does that mean that it's open and shut that they're the greatest team of all time? No, of course not. And there's other metrics that show that the Warriors belong in the conversation of the greatest teams of all time, along with like the 71 Milwaukee Bucks and the 2001 Lakers, if we're talking about great playoff runs, but that they're not far and away the best or definitively the best. And they had a chance. The interesting thing is that probably if they had swept and completed the and gone through the playoffs undefeated, they probably would have been the universally accepted kind of default answer for who's the greatest NBA team of all time. They would have replaced the 96 Bulls. One, was it 21-point loss, you know, does ding you in these stats that really kind of focus on your greatness compared to the entire universe of NBA history. So, you know, it sounds silly, like you said, Chad, to have one loss make that much of a difference, but I think that was the difference between them being the go-to answer as to who's the best NBA team of all time and them just being one of many potential answers, or not that many, but still kind of in the inner circle of potential answers.
Well, it seems like we're having two conversations here. There's the one conversation to me, are the Warriors the greatest team ever in terms of could this Warriors team beat any previous incarnation of any team? And in my mind, the rational answer to that is yes. Now, the second conversation that we're having is a conversation about the conversation and the guidelines of the conversation. Because if you're saying, is this Warriors team the best comparatively of any era with different rules, what rules are we playing with? Can Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen and Ron Harper and Dennis Rodman grow up in the 90s and 2000s and have the same nutrition and technology? There are just so many loopholes you have to jump through when you compare eras. When you're flat out asking the question about, I hate that I just said flat out, but when you're asking the question about the Golden State Warriors as the best basketball team ever, could they have beaten any other iteration of basketball teams in the NBA? I don't see how you logically end up at the answer of no, unless you want to play the game of, well, hand-checking, three-point line, nutrition, technology, because otherwise you have a Golden State Warriors team that is more evolved than any other basketball team in history. And if you're comparing them to the 1996 Bulls, that's 20 years of NBA evolution. That's like a little less than a third of all NBA evolution that these Warriors have had the benefits of in terms of growth, size, technology, nutrition. There's just no way that any other team, especially from a different era, would ever beat these Warriors.
Yeah, and Steve Kerr had like this great sarcastic response to somebody asking this question about these ex-players saying, oh, they could beat the Warriors, where he's like, yeah, the game gets worse as time goes on. It's weird how human evolution goes in reverse in sports. Players get weaker, smaller, less skilled. I can't explain it. It was like the best troll response possible to that question.
The other thing about this is, like, when we talk about era-adjusted or whatever and we want to get down to the matchups, you start at the top, Jordan, Pippen, Rodman. Well, for one thing, they weren't guarding Steph, Clay, and Draymond and, you know, KD. But for another thing, down the roster is where you really see, like, shifts in player skill. How many players on the Warriors can create a shot off the dribble, can, like, use a screen effectively to get themselves open for a three? a lot, like most of the team probably. There's probably 11 guys who can do that versus like the 96 Bulls where it was a lot of standing around playing the triangle.
Well, you even saw that against the Cavs where Kyle Korver was still just standing in the corner, and it was a real contrast to what was happening for the Warriors where there wasn't anyone just waiting for the ball to get to them. It was cuts and dribbles and whatever else, which I think brings us to sort of what makes the Warriors so good. And Kyle, you've been writing about that quite a bit throughout the series and throughout the playoffs, and today you wrote sort of a more forward-looking column just about like how the Warriors bent the NBA to its will and then somehow transcended what it bent it to. So I was wondering if you could talk a bit about sort of what defines this team.
Sure. So when we think about smart basketball in the last couple years, we think about like basically Daryl Morey and the Houston Rockets and the model of draw a lot of fouls, shoot a lot of three-pointers, just play the up-and-down game, get out in transition. And the Warriors do some of that. They play at a fast pace. They obviously shoot a lot of threes, but they do a lot of the stuff that you're not supposed to do. So Steph Curry, when he was making his rise to basically MVP level, started shooting all these pull-up jumpers. The pull-up jumpers are the worst shot in the game, or they were thought to be, because, well, they're less efficient. They're, like, you make them less often than when you shoot off of the catch and shoot. They still take a lot of long twos. They don't draw a lot of fouls. Like, they draw fewer fouls than most of the playoff teams out there. And, like, if you were looking at this as a what not to do, like, if the Knicks were doing these things, you would make fun of the Knicks saying, like, they don't, they're playing caveman ball. They don't know what they're doing. We made fun of the Lakers when the Lakers were, like, the team that shot the most two-pointers in the league.
Right.
Or long two-pointers. But the Warriors are making this work because all of their other threats that are on the floor make that these things, like, places where they're not being guarded. So they have David West. They have Kevin Durant and guys who can make these long two-pointers. They have guys who can, you know, score at the rim and, you know, pass out without having to take that abuse, take the beating of, like, drawing all these free throws. And they're making things that we think about as inefficient actually work for them and be efficient for them.
And do you think that's also an argument that, and this is something we've talked about too, that this is just the greatest collection of raw talent, period, in NBA history too? So, you know, maybe that also papers over some of the things like you talked about, but also it's probably an argument that even players that are doing things kind of counter to what maybe the average player needs to do to statistically max out their game, when they are like actually really talented players, it creates these synergies that are kind of go beyond and compound to create something that's greater than the sum of its parts.
To me, that gets at like a really important part of this team, because we saw what happened when there was just a simple style change. And that gets at the core reward. The 2014 Warriors under Mark Jackson played a specific kind of ball. They were, I think, third in the league in isolations, played a very risk-averse style of offense. 2015 rolls around, and the Warriors are throwing all these no-look passes, taking these crazy shots, and their efficiency goes through the roof a lot because teams just weren't prepared to deal with a team that was, you know, so comfortable playing with all this risk. So, yeah, I think that there's something to be said for, like, players that are doing something else, but also, like, there's just a wider world of, you know, the way that you can play basketball than just the stodgy, you know, Morey ball style.
And I don't know at this point that we have actually seen the iteration of these Warriors that has fully absorbed all of the talent that exists on the roster. I mean, you mentioned synergy and how it's difficult to categorize the synergy that has been created on these Warriors, and you see it so much even just by looking at the example of Kevin Durant. One, from the sole fact that he wanted to go to the Golden State Warriors, which by all accounts had, of course, a lot to do with how well positioned they were and the talent that they already had, but also through his own admission was very much to do about the culture and the energy around playing for the Golden State Warriors and whatever that variable of chemistry is. And so then Kevin Durant shows up, and when you look at the way this Warriors team played in this season, in this postseason, they just are scratching really the surface of the synergy that might exist between these players. I mean, even in the middle of the season, we saw moments where they felt like Durant was doing too much at the end of games, and they kind of had to have a come to Jesus about that, or even the way Durant's behavior would be on fast breaks in terms of where he would end up locating and how they wanted to change those things. I mean, there's just so many synergistic elements of this Golden State Warriors team that if it stays together for 2-3 more seasons, you're going to see a kind of interaction an energy and chemistry between them, assuming nothing falls apart, that we didn't even get to see this year.
So, Kate, I have a question for you on that. As someone who has played the game, Durant has talked about, you know, that culture, and he was looking for a culture that, you know, benefited him. But it seems to me that if Durant was doing a lot of the stuff that he's doing this year, which is, you know, working off the ball, running off these screens, setting off ball screens, establishing deep in the post, calling for the ball, turning around, shooting quick, catching on the move, going to the rim, stuff that we didn't see in the ISO-heavy Oklahoma City, that him and Russ might have some championships by now. So how much do you buy into that, like, he just needed a culture around him, that he needed this team around him, and how much of it is just, well, Kevin Durant's playing a very different game here?
Well, I think it's got to be a blend of both of those things, because I think, you know, just from my experience, when you're in an environment around people who are willing to accept mistakes and there's a good energy around it, then you want to make certain changes and you refocus what you want your energy to be about, what you're chasing. And so, and again, having not, of course, not been around the Oklahoma City Thunder except in passing at certain NBA games, if you have a culture there where you don't want to have to set a flare screen when there's an offensive rebound, you get stuck in your habits and you don't necessarily see the motivation to change them. And then when you get to a place like Kevin Durant did with Golden State, and you know that everyone around you is absorbing that type of feedback and making the kind of changes that you see Golden State make, Steph Curry, Klay Thompson make, then you want to make them yourself. And I'm not trying to, like, mythologize Golden State here, because it seems like they've had their issues, whether it's Draymond in the locker room or certain moments during this season. But there's just, again, when you have that abundance of talent and you can see that the equation of changing your behavior patterns and admitting to mistakes equals the kind of output they're getting, well, then you certainly will then absorb so much more of an ability to change within yourself.
So I want to shift just a little bit to LeBron. We were talking at 538 a while back about who filled LeBron's graveyard. Who were the teams and players who just could never quite break through the finals, because LeBron's made it, I think, 7 straight years now. It seems to me like LeBron is in the Warriors' graveyard a little bit. And aside from a Herculean performance last year, could be buried even further than he is. And I'm wondering, you know, we are extolling the Warriors' greatness. What does this tell us about LeBron's greatness, that the Warriors were be able to be so great against LeBron?
So to me, this series kind of goes as far of making LeBron's legacy as the previous two. Because think about last year. We all looked at that team and thought, okay, they're winning this thing, they're getting back into it because, well, Draymond suspended for this game. Steph clearly doesn't look like he's physically correct. And it always just seemed like, well, if the Warriors would have just ever get their act together, play the Warriors style that we know they were capable of during the regular season, this Cavs team, which is just scraping by on fumes here, might not have it. A year goes by. They add Kevin Durant. They get much better. And all of a sudden, like in these final three games of the series, they're basically achieved equilibrium to a point where we were looking at this team and Steph did look right. Draymond was there. Kevin Durant was on the floor, and they were playing them basically to a standstill over three games. And to me, like, that is crazy. LeBron's team is nowhere near as good as this. Like, he's a genius that he got this team playing at that level.
I 100% agree that when you actually rationally look at what LeBron's done and the level he has brought a team to without the same talent as Golden State, that is incredible. The problem is our human historical nature of just seeing whatever the outcome is and then not necessarily digging into the process of it if the outcome, in this case, isn't an NBA championship. I just don't think, with how heavily focused we are, and I know, Kyle, you would totally agree with this, how heavily focused we are on the NBA championship, that even when we look back in the rearview mirror of LeBron's career, that we're even going to discuss a losing effort. You know, it's just, it's, even if it's remarkable, it doesn't get him the kind of medals hanging on that legacy that will change people's minds going forward.
Yeah, and that's the thing about the way that we've judged players, especially, I don't know if this started with Jordan, started with Bird and Magic, but the way that we sort of are so single-mindedly focused on the championship, and that drove LeBron to leave Cleveland in the first place and go to Miami, was kind of, he was part of this, we talked about this last week, this generation of players that wanted to go out and get their championship, and they were not satisfied with being, you know, Kevin Garnett in Minnesota, you know, and just being on like an outpost. They wanted to uproot themselves and leave and go get that championship. But now we're seeing, you know, the what happens when one team contains more of those guys than the other team that contains also some of those guys. And that kind of gets back to the take at the top of the segment also, where, you know, people think that the Warriors didn't necessarily face very tough competition, but the Cavs were very tough competition. Like you said, I mean, they have the what is at very least one of the top two or three players, if not the best player in the world, playing at his best, I think. And it still wasn't enough for the Cavs because the Warriors just had so much talent on the team. And so is it, you know, I'd like to dig into this question of, like, is it an easy path for a team like the Warriors when they just went out and aggregated more talent than everyone else, when the Cavs are as good as the sort of normal team that a team would have to face in the finals, you know, in the past? You know, the Jordan teams faced probably on average a team as good as the Cavs. And so, you know, but we have this sense that it was such a weaker slate because both of the finals teams breezed through their respective conferences, and then the finals itself was not actually really, you know, as competitive as we hoped it would be. So it's just a fascinating thing when the balance of talent in the league is so sort of shifted around that the old rules of what we think about, you know, the signposts of making it to the conference finals, making it to the finals, winning the finals, it's not an apples to apples comparison, even with as recently as like a decade ago of NBA history, much less like way back in the past.
And I also think that we have less sympathy for LeBron James simply because we see his roster as a hodgepodge compilation of talent. I think it would be different if he had never left Cleveland and if we saw it as like this homegrown roster that wasn't poaching free agents and making those mega blockbuster deals. Like, we very much still view LeBron as the poster child for super teams and the amalgamation of talent onto one roster. And like, the Cavs are that to a degree as well. And so I think there's less sympathy that we have as like consumers of the NBA, that they're not just like the Cleveland Cavaliers built only through the draft and through the traditional pieces, even if it's mythologizing the past in that way. We still don't even see Cleveland as that.
So I've got two things on that. One is that the core contributors, aside from, actually, if we could include LeBron because he was the number one pick at Cleveland at some point.
I guess you have to agree to include LeBron as like an original Cavaliers member, right?
But the core contributors are Kyrie Irving and Tristan Thompson, like on top of Kevin Love. One of the really interesting things is how right LeBron was. Like, everyone likes to lambast like GM LeBron. But earlier in the season, he was saying that they were a little too top heavy, they needed a little more depth, and they really needed a point guard. And you saw in the series, like, failing this last game, sort of, Darren looked like he shouldn't be on the floor out there, and they really needed that backup point guard. When Shump and JR weren't giving them anything, there was no answer for that because the bench was just as shallow as LeBron said. So, like, GM LeBron was right.
Can I just jump in on that really quickly? The Times wrote a piece about LeBron after the game and sort of what he was saying in the locker room, and the final closing anecdote is LeBron saying, you know, I'm going to go back to the gym. It's just a lifestyle for me. You know, I'm not going to sort of lick my wounds. And then the quote is about talking about the Warriors and how the Cavaliers are finally going to get over the hump. LeBron says, I need to sit down and figure this out, James said, as if the ball were squarely in his court. And he is thinking in that way as GM LeBron. And I think the final question I have for you guys, and we should make it quick, is we have this Warriors team that is likely, depending on some contract shenanigans, going to be together for at least, a 2 to 3 year window here, maybe without Iguodala, but more or less the core that we see. What do the stats, or just common sense, or what we know about the NBA now, tell us about how to build a team to go up against the Warriors? Or alternatively, to not even try and to sit back and hoard your picks and then figure out what to do in year five?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough. Kyle and I were looking at sort of the best case scenarios of teams that aggregated a lot of young talent. So, for instance, this would be the building through the draft model of trying to build a Warriors killer. And even if you had like the best collection of young talent that we've seen in recent years, so like the 2016 T-Wolves would be a team like this, or the 2003 Baby Bulls or something like that, and those players all panned out to like the, you know, top percentile of their possible outcomes. outcomes. And so you ended up with, you know, this core developing, maybe like a OKC with Harden and Durant and Westbrook. Even that team at its absolute peak would only be as good as the Cavs team that the Warriors just kind of demolished in five games. So that kind of is a sobering thought about the idea of how you might build that. If you tanked and if everything worked right in your tank and all of your players that you got through tanking ended up becoming stars, even then it would probably not be enough to even have like a 50-50 shot against a Warriors caliber team.
So for me, getting past that, like, one, that is ridiculous. But two, once you get past that and you say, okay, we're going to pan out, hopefully we get these good players, player type then starts to matter. And so we did a story a while ago about how 3-and-D players, like true 3-and-D players, are actually, for as long as we've been looking for them, still pretty rare in the league. And if the Warriors are playing this style where they're running off all these screens, where Zaza is out there, you know, just being a goon in the middle, and, like, they actually shoot much better from three when Zaza's on the floor, which, like, you wouldn't expect, but, like, that's how their system works, then defenders who can chase them around, and, like, my line is that they look like a drunk guy playing as the Warriors in 2K. But so you need, like, defenders who can chase them around those screens, and defenders who can both do that and shoot the three or, like, handle the ball are really rare in the league. So not only are they perfectly constructed, like, from a talent standpoint, but their system is maximizing the inefficiencies, like, in the talent pool.
Right,
in
the
general.
Resource, yeah. That's interesting. Kate, any last word on that?
I think if the NBA and the Warriors have taught me anything about how to build a team, it's don't use whatever the existing model is. I mean, I think if we go back, we look at the Boston Celtics and we're like, oh, that's the model. And then the Warriors didn't fit that model. And then we're like, well, now it's the Warriors model. And whatever, it's easy to paste onto the future what we've seen in the present. Like, oh, the Warriors will keep playing in this way. And we look around the league and we don't necessarily see, maybe with the exception of the Boston Celtics, like a ton of future assets that seem to be able to build in the way that we saw the Golden State Warriors do. But I would anticipate, obviously, that they're team that challenges them future-wise, not necessarily in the next year or two with whatever LeBron James might do, it's going to be completely unexpected and probably be a different model. They'll see some sort of gap or loophole that the Warriors and the way every NBA team will probably try and emulate the Warriors and, like, leave this gaping hole for some other team that's going to do something a totally different way to fill. I mean, I think it's like, to use the analogy in, like, the book world, like, everybody wanted a wizard's book after Harry Potter. Then somebody came around with a vampire book, unexpected, and everybody then started doing vampire books. Like, it's always going to be the unexpected thing, I think, that fills the gap that ends up surprising us in the way it might spin the NBA going forward.
LeBron was totally Team Edward. All right, let's let's leave it there, and we'll probably talk about the NBA again next week with the draft. It's amazing. The league ends, and it still takes up all this oxygen. But you know what? Compared to football, I much prefer talking
about
the
NBA. Chad, you know, you're the one who said we would go a long time without talking about the NFL, so.
All right, Kyle Wagner, thanks for chatting about the NBA Finals.
Always nice to be here.
Okay, now on to our significant digit. When a telling number from the world of sports is delivered to the show, I'm delivering it today, guys. I'm going to deliver the number 10. That's the number of French Open titles that Rafael Nadal has won after he won his first Grand Slam title in 3 years last weekend, winning the French again after a very long hiatus of not winning much of note at all. I wanted to bring it up to talk about Nadal's greatness, sort of relative to the Warriors' greatness that we just got done talking about, because from where I sit, and you know, Neil, we don't have like updated men's ELO numbers, but I know that Nadal was lower than Djokovic and Federer a couple years ago. It seems to me as though, like, Nadal's never going to get the sort of same credit as other tennis players because he is so dominant on this one surface, even though he's now only 3 Grand Slams behind Roger Federer and has more than Pete Sampras.
Yeah. Like, for some reason, he seems like a specialist in our minds.
But that seems probably not quite right.
It's not quite fair, but I think it's like in hockey, if somebody's an enforcer and they're awesome at it, I mean, you get it. Like, or in basketball, where he used to be a three-point specialist, we have this idea around him that he's really awesome at one thing, but not as well-rounded as some of these other champions who have, like, more balanced Grand Slam title wins. And to some degree, that is true because he's so heavily in the category of the French Open with such a different surface.
Yeah, but also, you know, first of all, yeah, it's kind of a good question of would you rather be the best ever at one particular specialty or discipline within a sport that comes up relatively often, is emphasized, you know, with a decent amount of weight. And also, let's not, you know, away from the French Open, so he's won 10 French Opens, but he's also won 5 Grand Slams that were not at the French Open.
And the
which
career Grand Slam is as, every place.
Right, which is as much as, like, if you took away his French Opens, he still would be tied for the 28th most Grand Slams of any player ever.
Yeah, but so here's my question, is, and this is how I think of it. I think if he'd won 10 U.S. Opens, or Australians for that matter, it's not like a jingoistic, like, oh, the U.S. Open in New York, but the surface seems like the great equalizer. In just in a general assessment of tennis, I'm like, oh, that's a basic surface, and every good tennis player will have an equal chance on it. Versus when I see him winning the French Open, what I think is that there are fewer tennis players who are good on that surface, and then therefore the percentage chances of winning the French Open are slightly greater, even though they're obviously very low when you get to that elite level.
But I think that's what Neil is saying, which is that he's won 5 not on on clay.
Yeah, but I'm saying if that number, but it's still 5, and it's not this, the heavily weighted number is still in this specialized area, and I didn't know I was a Rafael Nadal hater until we started this Sig dig.
Yeah, the interesting thing, though, is, you know, we talk about ELO a lot on this, the rating system that sort of parcels out points based on how likely you are to win on a surface. So theoretically, if you become the best clay player possible, you would get to the point where you couldn't actually add ELO to your score because there would be no one to kind of take the points from. You would be favored, you know, almost 100% in all of your matches. And yet Nadal's clay ELO, specific ELO, and this is according to TennisAbstract.com, which is a site we've used before. So it's number 1 in the world, which is not surprising at all. But it's a higher number on clay than anyone else is at either hard or grass, which tells me that he actually is, you know, if it was just a matter of nobody else being very good at that surface, then it wouldn't be as easy for him to gain points and kind of rack up the dominant number as it would be. And you would think grass also, by the way, would be another kind of specialty. We talk about Andy Murray, you know, people like that specialized, Pete Sampras in a previous era, that do better on that surface. And the rating of the best player Murray on grass is far below the rating that Nadal has on clay. So I think, you know, it is a little bit of a misnomer or a misconception that, you know, he's just lapping up all of these titles because there's not enough competition on that particular surface. I still think that, you know, it's pretty hard to dominate any surface to the extent that he's dominated clay.
All right, Neil, impressed. Kate, unimpressed.
I am. I'm impressed, guys. I am. I'm impressed.
I also am impressed as someone who can't play tennis. All right, that'll do it for this week's show. Kate Fagan, when do you come back to us out east?
I will be back next week.
Amazing.
For Hot Takedown.
Excellent. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks, Chad.
Neil Payne. I almost called you Neil Fain because it's
odd.
Kate Fagan.
It's a blending of names.
And Neil Payne. Neil, thanks for talking about sports.
Thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Martin Onebu. Our intern is Alice Wilder. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app and on iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, subscribing your friends, be sure to review and or rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I am Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.